It's At the Letters, brought to you by Miller Lite, the original light beer, for Thursday, October 6th. Arden Zwelling and Ben Nicholson-Smith here at Rogers Center on Blue Jays workout day ahead of the wildcard series against the Seattle Mariners this weekend. Want to thank Devlin Brand for helping us out on site. Want to thank Christian Ryan, as always, for working on the audio of this podcast. Ben, where are you at entering the weekend? It feels like it's been 7 months, man, that we have been every day with this team, literally since spring training, since the lockout ended. It's all been for this.
Yeah, it's an exciting time for the Blue Jays. It's a busy time, certainly for them, for us as well. You're obviously just in Baltimore doing the part of the broadcast there. So it's busy. It's exciting. You know, selfishly, I look at it and I see 4 p.m., 4 p.m., 2 p.m. Love that. That is ideal. That is a great setup. I think it's great for fans of this team and fans of baseball in Toronto to have baseball, playoff baseball, back here for the first time in 6 years. It's definitely been too long, so it'll be great to see what they can do. But, you know, we've said this a few times, really, I wouldn't be surprised if they're playing in 3-4 weeks, but I also wouldn't be surprised, and, you know, let's hope for the sake of our listeners that this isn't the case, but how surprised could you be if this is all over after a couple of days? So got to enjoy it here and see what this weekend has in store.
It's funny, because during the regular season, I really don't like the 3 p.m. starts from a working perspective. I think for fans, it's great, but just for the very small amount of people who would be impacted from working perspective, not that anybody cares about our trials and tribulations, but it really screws up your morning and your night, like the 3 o'clock start. Because for us, like, you're getting to the ballpark 4 hours minimum before first pitch, typically. So you think about it, for a 3 o'clock start, you're at the ballpark at 11. So you're leaving home before that. You really can't do much in the morning. And then the game goes, let's say, like 3 till 6:30, 7 o'clock. We're working for an hour, sometimes two, at post game, probably more like two most days. Might even be 2.5, depending on what kind of crazy game it was. So now you're getting out of the ballpark at 9 p.m. and it's like you don't really have much of a night. So it kind of screws up your morning and your night. So I don't love those 3 p.m. starts during the regular season. Love the 4 o'clock during the playoffs, because the playoffs is just like we have kind of just handed our lives over to the baseball gods for the next month. And it might only be for 2 days this weekend. It might be for several weeks with us on early morning flights and traveling around and just kind of being at the whims of whatever happens to this ball club. So I've like resigned my fate to not having a personal life for the next little bit. So I am actually okay with the earlier start time. So it's only like a maybe you get out of here at 11 p.m., 12 a.m. rather than like 2 a.m., 3 a.m.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll see if and when the baseball gods give our lives back. wondering when that moment will occur. But certainly not wanting to rush that moment either. I think it's a fun time. Even now, we're down here at Rogers Center, as you said, after the Blue Jays workout. And so you're kind of reminded. There's this, for me, I haven't covered a playoff game since 2016 because the last time the Jays were in was 2020, pandemic season. And so this muscle memory kind of kicks in of, oh yeah, this is where they have this event and this is how this unfolds, all the mechanics behind the scenes. It is a little bit of a different cadence and a really fun one. And the stakes are just so high for everyone involved. Everyone knows it. Every inning matters. So the games that we're about to watch, they might be lopsided, but there's no doubting the significance of these games.
And being here for the first time since 2016 really was important to the club. I know like a lot of people say that, right? And you kind of think, well, just being in the postseason matters, but the Blue Jays really pushed for this, like, as a team. And that's from talking to Blue Jays and talking to their coaches. They pushed for this. They wanted it. They talked about it. After they clinched on that off day and had the celebration on the Friday, like, they didn't say, oh, we're going to, field our B lineup from here on out. We're going to take our foot off the gas. Like, they kept throttling and they kept going because they wanted home field advantage in this wildcard series. They wanted to play playoff games here in 2016. It's for the first time since 2016. And it's not just because it's been that long, but it's because of the years when they weren't here at all, when they were in Buffalo and Dunedin.
Yeah, absolutely. And that makes me think too, man, it's been a long time since we actually podcasted. There's a lot that's happened, like that celebration here in Toronto.
Yep.
Pretty wild celebration. Go to Baltimore, clinch home field. And then now they're setting up for their playoff run here against the Mariners, which, you know, to your point, I think it makes a definite difference in the eyes of the players. They want to be at home. The coaches clearly wanted to be at home. And some of that is comfort. If you look at the percentages, home field advantage in baseball is 52% to 48%. So it's not a huge percentage, but it's there. And sometimes you just need one moment where the crowd gets on an opposing player. Maybe there's a balk. Maybe there's an error. Those things happen, and those things don't happen in instructional league as often as they happen in the playoffs because that pressure exists and it's real.
And what you just said makes me think of Gerrit Cole when he balked here when the Yankees were here about a week ago, and he tried to play it off like it was the pitch calm, but dude, you're in your delivery, you're in your pitching motion. There's nothing going on with pitch calm in that moment. So that is an example of the crowd getting to Gerrit Cole, getting to a pitcher. We saw it happen with Johnny Cueto. This actually reminds me of a question that we were sent, and thank you to everybody who entered the mailbag contest through Miller Lite, and the three questions that we selected are going to get drawstring backpacks, so congratulations to those people. And here's the first question. It's from Andrew Mayo in Newfoundland, who asks, Ben, do you think the playoff crowds will cause havoc with PitchCom?
Great question. And thanks to everyone who submitted them. Obviously, only the winners will get those bags, but really appreciate all the questions from all our listeners. And the short answer here, Andrew, is yeah, I think they will. I mean, this is a new wrinkle in the playoffs this year to have PitchCom in the playoffs. We haven't seen that before. And so the crowds will get loud, especially if the dome is closed here in Toronto. It could get really loud. And so for the pitchers and catchers who are using PitchCom, it actually might be more difficult for them than they've ever experienced. And that could create some wrinkles and could add to that home field advantage.
I was talking to Pete Walker in Baltimore just about the atmosphere at Rogers Center during the postseason, because like he hasn't pitched in the postseason at Rogers Center, but he has pitched on that mound literally, and he has coached a ton of players through it, and he was here in 15, here in 16, and he was like, dude, I remember David Price telling me when he took the field in 2015 how different it was. David Price, not a guy who's like short on big game experience, and not a guy who like, oh, I've never been in a pressure packed environment before. Absolutely David Price had when he came to the Blue Jays, and even he was saying, it's different, man. Like this, like the crowd, the atmosphere, you do feel it and you do get energy from it. I almost wonder if that's even a little bit of like a double-edged sword sometimes, yeah. Because like baseball is a real fine motor skill sport. And it's like execution for pitchers is really important. It doesn't take a lot to fly open. It doesn't take a lot to overthrow. It doesn't take a lot to like get out of your mechanics and lose the zone. So for as much energy as Blue Jays pitchers are going to derive, as Alec Manoa is going to derive on the mound from that crowd, he also has to kind of have techniques and rhythms and ways to calm himself and to lower that heartbeat. I talked to Bo Bichette about it in Baltimore, and he was telling me, he was like, lately, I've just been looking at the last row of seats. And that's what he does before his plate appearances. He looks up and he looks at the very last row, and he says that kind of centers him. Remember Mitch White? I think he said this on the podcast, yep. Maybe he said in passing to us, but he said he looks for a zero in the stadium. Dude, yeah. I did that the other night in this is a tangent now, man. Yeah. I did that the other night in Baltimore. So the first night in Baltimore, I'm sitting in the camera well. Yeah. It's like 9 degrees, pouring rain, right? So freezing. I'm out there for 3 hours. And I was like, am I going to make it through this? And I literally was like, oh, yeah. I looked for a zero and I found a zero, right? It was in an advertisement. I forget what the ad was for, and I found a zero, or maybe it was an O, and I just like stared at that and kind of meditated on it for a while and was like, oh, I don't feel the cold and the rain that much anymore. It kind of works. So like I do think that Blue Jays players, yes, they're going to be hyped up, and yes, they're going to derive a lot of energy from this crowd, but they're also going to have ways to center themselves and calm themselves and remember to focus on process and technique and execution in a very, very fine motor skill sport.
Well, yeah, this is an organization that employs mental skills coaches 12 months a year, but they're certainly going to have their calendars full this week, or at least they should. Yeah, it's a really intense time of year. I think you're right. I think we're not watching these guys try to do their max deadlift or bench press, right? In that case, the crowd might be a pure positive. In this case, I wouldn't know. I don't do either of those things, but in theory, it could be. In this case, though, you're right. There is some real finesse required. And you think about Kevin Gausman as he's trying to recover from the splitter or the cut on his right middle finger, and how fine that grip is when he throws the splitter. He threw a bullpen here today. came out of that bullpen fine. But again, he doesn't throw the splitter in the bullpen for that very reason, because it is such a fine sport in a lot of these situations. So that's the beauty of it. I mean, that's where the guys who can respond best will probably be on the winning side.
You do feed off of energy, like whether there's two people around you or whether there's 49,000 people around you, right? And it does impact you. Like, that's a very real thing. I've never been in the situation where I'm trying to perform my job in front of, well, maybe sometimes. Yeah.
We both have.
Yeah, maybe we have, right? Yeah. And it, but that does get to you a little bit, doesn't it? Like, when I'm doing a walk-off interview on the field, like after a game on a weekend and there's 40,000 people in the stands and my interview is going to the bowl. Yeah, I feel that, right? Like, you want to talk about performance anxiety, like that's there.
Of course. And I think, like, anytime, I won't reveal too much here, but, you know, there are times that if you're doing these TV hits or radio hits, whatever the case, sometimes it's useful just to remind yourself, yeah, no one's watching, and create this cognitive dissonance in your mind where you actually say, no one's watching. So those are the techniques that, you know, are useful for people who don't have to compete against someone else, because that's the thing. You know, you're not competing if you're, you know, talking about baseball. There's no one on the other side trying to defeat you. But that's what these players are up against.
It's another thing I was talking to Bo about, man, in Baltimore. He was saying, you know, I don't think I've actually been to the postseason yet. I don't consider myself having experienced it. Because look, when they played in 2020 at the Trop, before cardboard cutouts with pumped in crowd noise at the end of a 60 game, like weird topsy turvy year in the middle of a pandemic, it didn't feel like the postseason. So Bo was saying, like, I think this is our first postseason for myself, for Vlad, for Kevin, for Alejandro Kirk, for all these guys, right? So it is going to be a test of a very young Blue Jays position player core. Like, you think about it, this Blue Jays position player group, average age 27.1. It's going to be the second youngest group in the postseason after the Cleveland Guardians. You're going to be relying on Alejandro Kirk, who I'm sure is going to catch Alek Manoah in game one, to game call and to be running the strategy on the field. This is a 24-year-old we're talking about here. He might actually be 23. Alek Manoah, 23 or 24.
24.
Right? Yeah. Alek Manoah, 24, is going to be throwing the first pitch of the game in that atmosphere. He's going to be a guy who you were counting on to log innings. Who's going to be hitting atop your order after George Springer? It's got Bo Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr., guys who, yeah, there's 4 years like on their baseball reference pages, but one of those years was a rookie year. One of those years is 2020, that weird season I was referring to. Bo said this, I feel like I'm in my second year in the big leagues. Like, I feel like I just finished my second true big league season. Very young players, very inexperienced players. It's going to be really interesting to see them tested on the stage.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I mean, this is where, you know, the Jays have this chance to deliver on their promise, which is immense. I mean, Bo, second season or not, led the league in hits this year, despite the slow start that he had. I mean, kind of wild. But this is it. This is where they can really start making good on their promise as players and as a core, as a collective, or they fizzle out and it doesn't happen. All of a sudden, you start counting down the years until Vlad and Bo are testing free agency. And you don't want to be playing that game if you're the Blue Jays. You want to be saying, all right, we had an amazing playoff run. Now let's build on that. Not, are we going to waste this opportunity? And really, this weekend is massive in tipping the scales one way or the other.
So Fangraphs has the odds for the series as 54.2% for the Blue Jays, 45.8% for the Mariners. Does that read right to you?
I think if you would ask me to pick it without looking, I probably would have picked almost exactly in that range. You know, 53 to 55 Jays, and then the Mariners, you know, in the high 40s. What about you? I mean, is
55-45, I think is totally fair for the Blue Jays, which means there is still 45% of outcomes where the Mariners win this series. The Mariners could easily win this series, and the Blue Jays season is over by Monday.
Yeah, and no one... You know, if you're the Jays, you definitely can't let that into your head. You got to be
walked down there. Hey, guys.
And certainly, you know, the way they celebrated on Friday, they really celebrated like they hadn't had that chance in a while. And as a quick aside, they should be celebrating anytime you get to the playoffs in the major leagues.
Save it. We'll get there.
We'll get there. I mean, you got to do it. You got to do it. So this is a group, that they'll have a chance now to really be able to start pushing things forward and Yeah, I think they're the better team. I think they have a way better offense. I think they've certainly got the pitching to compete with the Mariners, and home field will help. So to me, that's a team that's in a very good position to win this series.
It's interesting. They're similar clubs, right? In that they've got that like top end pitching depth. Like, I really don't know which side of the coin I would like, if like one side is Castillo and Ray and the other side is Manoah and Gausman. That's as much of a push, I think, as I can figure.
I guess once you throw in Stripling and Gilbert, Mariners to me have
I would take the Mariners at that point. But you don't know you're going to three games, right? So I'm just going first two. First two, I honestly think it's pretty even. I don't know how to pick between those two.
It's close. I mean, Castillo from a stuff standpoint is just nasty. Manoah, you know, we talk about heartbeat and the kind of challenge of staying composed when there's so much pressure. Manoah is someone that certainly people around the Jays describe him as like on a level, even though he hasn't yet played in the postseason, the kind of guy who can really thrive in that environment. So very curious to see what he can do. But the fact is, he's probably going to come out in the first inning throwing 92. You know, Castillo is going to be throwing 99. So it really is a different story.
The thing with Manoah that's so key is they've gotten him a nice extended rest before the postseason, because we've seen him so many times this year take the mound without his best stuff, and he's making adjustments, and he's reading swings, he's figuring out what's working for him that day, what's not working for the opposition hitters, and he's just kind of like adjusting his way through it, and he's finding his way through, and he's being like, okay, I'm not going to strike out eight today, I'll just be contact management, Alek Manoah. And it's great that you have that ability, right? With the two-seamer, with your slider, with your changeup, right? Like, it's great that you can do those things. But what's even better is if you have that plus 95-96, plus a slider that's like a slider that's snapping, and like a changeup that's really fading away from lefties. Like, that's what you want. You want both. And I feel like a lot of times this year on 4 days rest, you've seen contact management, Alek Manoah, and the hope for the Blue Jays with the amount of rest they got him ahead of this start and the way he was able to kind of hone in on his routines. I think the hope is you're going to have stuff Alek Manoah and contact management Alek Manoah.
Best case scenario, he goes out there, throws 6-7 innings, allows a couple runs, and that's totally imaginable. It really is. In the scenario where he does not have his best stuff, however, the Jays have to be prepared, and I think they will, to take him out of there in the fourth inning. Like, you have to be ready to go to the bullpen early. The stakes are too high. You can only afford to lose one game in this series. So you have to lose that game carefully. You have to spend that loss very carefully. And if you are not in a position to lose any games, which, you know, Manoah, they will, because it'll be game one, but you have to manage extremely aggressively. If that means Tim Mays is coming in the fifth, Jimmy Garcia in the sixth, you know, Anthony Bass in the third, do what you have to do. You know, Jordan Romano for six outs, this is the time of year that it is imperative you make that pitching change one batter too early and not too late.
Even if things go well first two trips through, top of the Mariners order comes back up, and like, say it's a bloop and a walk, you got to be ready to make that move. Even if Manoah hasn't given up like super hard contact at that point, you got to be ready to make that move. So I think there's absolutely like a spot early in a game, like early quote unquote being like, I don't know, fifth inning for like a Bass, you know, or if it's like, if it had to be like Meza against tough lefties, or even a Richards in a spot, right? Like, I don't know, but I think there's going to be like a pretty, you know, there's going to be a stressful moment, I think, in a middle inning spot where you're seeing a really good reliever coming in to get some big outs.
And if it's not Manoah, it'll be Stripling or Gausman, whoever starts game two. That's still at this point unclear as we record this, probably by the time most people are listening. Well, actually, I don't know, because the Jays might decide after game one, based on what John Schneider said when I asked him, you know, are you guys willing to go into game one without having your game two starter finalized? He said, yeah, that's on the table. So that kind of leads me to believe in both Stripling and Gausman through bullpens on Thursday. Either one of them could go at any time. I kind of think that they're going to play it by ear, which is something that you've discussed. And you know, it's an interesting concept. And I think it might be the right call at this point.
I pitched it last week on the podcast, and it's what I would do, is you start Alek Manoah in game one. If you win game one, you start Ross Stripling in game two. If you lose game one, you're starting Kevin Gausman in game two. But you win game one, you start Ross Stripling in game two. You try to win that second game with Ross Stripling, because if you do, and if you sweep the Mariners, now you've got Gausman twice in the DS, instead of having to spend Gausman in game two and having him only once in the DS. What's your worst case scenario? You drop game two and you still have Kevin Gausman in game three. So that's what I was pitching last week. I know the Blue Jays have discussed it, and I think they've been thinking through it a lot, and I think that there are a lot of different machinations that they've been considering. I wouldn't be surprised if they did that. Honestly, I also wouldn't be surprised if they just said, we're going to throw our best two pitchers in the first two games.
And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you know, it's a very fair way to proceed, and then that makes game three a bullpen game. That's fine. But if you just go with Gausman in the second game, again, some of that comes down to the finger, how it's healing. He seems to be in good spirits. You know, he says he's doing well and through that bullpen with no apparent issues. We'll see. You know, it's at this point up in the air, and that's how the playoffs should be. You shouldn't lock yourself in. You shouldn't go in saying he's our two, so he's going the second game. Stay flexible and adjust as you have to go.
As we head to break, let's knock off another one of these mailbag questions as we're talking about pitchers as well. Congratulations to Brian Swartz, who's going to get a backpack. And Brian's question is, if the need ever arose, who on the Jays pitching staff would be the best option to come into the game as a pinch runner, a la Marcus Stroman back in the 2016 season?
Very interesting question. Very interesting. Stroman was a great candidate for that. I don't see anyone quite at that level on this team. I might go Stripling. I mean, not in the series where he's starting, like in a playoff. Yeah, because he's a starter. Probably not. Yeah. Probably has to be a reliever. Although Ross Atkins did say that he thinks Stripling could play for the New England Patriots today. That was an interesting aside. But
I was kind of as far as me saying like Trevor Richards would come in the fifth inning of game one of that's not happening.
No.
And I don't think the Ross Stripling's playing for the New England Patriots.
I think those were
both pretty absurd things to say.
All right. So reliever, it has to be a reliever, right? I mean, it's,
you're not throwing a starter.
No, you're just not. Could this be, I mean, Phelps, no offense, David Phelps, you're probably too old to be that quick.
I'll tell you who I'm going with. I'm going Adam Simber. Because okay, I think he would be the fleetest of foot of the bunch of them. I don't want to put Jordan Romano in that spot, right? So I'm not putting a starter in that spot. I'm not putting Romano in that spot. Meza, Bass, Garcia, Phelps are all sort of larger, older individuals. Simber, and you know what? So, like, runner up.
I know my answer.
Yusei Kikuchi.
That's my answer.
Yeah.
It's Yusei. It's
honestly,
yeah.
Because he is, this is a terrible word, most expendable in a way, right? Like, in a way, like if something went absolutely wrong, right? Because you're putting a guy in an unfamiliar situation, so there could be an injury. So you don't want to risk somebody who's super, super crucial, right? That, and you say also, like, pretty underrated athlete, like great at fielding his position, great reactions, seems to move very well on the baseball field.
No doubt. And I've heard Romano's pretty fast, but you're not using him in that situation. And I like the Yusei call. That's my final answer. I will give a little shout out here to Jose Berríos, who I think would probably be the best. Great athlete, but you're not using him.
What's your reasoning for Yusei?
Similar. Good conditioning, good athlete, and he's not a core part of your pitching staff at this point.
You're risking the least.
Yeah.
And so, in a way, we're both saying we think Yusei Kikuchi is going to be on the postseason roster.
I do think that.
Yeah, I also think that.
Yeah.
And fans are going to know that by the time they listen to this. In this world right now, Ben and I don't know that. But I kind of think Yusei Kikuchi, as wild as it is to say that right now, I wouldn't have said this a week ago, as wild as it is to say that right now, I think Yusei Kikuchi is going to be on the postseason roster.
Agreed. And I don't think he'll pitch leverage, but he's pitched well. And this is a guy who, against a Mariners team with a ton of lefties and switch hitters, probably has a spot on this roster.
It's interesting. I was talking to someone about him in Baltimore, and they were kind of saying, you know, he's finally making the adjustments we were asking him to earlier this year. He's cut the cutter out of the repertoire, not throwing the cutter anymore. The Blue Jays hated that pitch, felt like he threw it in hitters counts, and it was an uncompetitive pitch, and that it got crushed. He's throwing the slider harder. The slider's in that 86 to 88 range, and we spent the entire like first half of this season talking about how Yusei Kikuchi needs to throw his slider harder. It's something the Blue Jays were on him about from spring training. He's finally doing that. He's still not using his fastball as much as the Blue Jays would like him to, but I mean, coming into that outing on the last day of the season, I don't have the updated stats in front of me, but Yusei Kikuchi had struck out like nearly 40% of the batters they'd faced as reliever. He'd still given up some crazy contact, and he'd still walked some dudes and hit some dudes, but the stuff was playing a lot better. And I think it's because he was finally making some of those adjustments that the Blue Jays were asking him to do earlier this year.
It's a great sign. And look, I still don't think that, you know, he's going to be pitching in leverage or anything of that sort, but I mean, what if game two goes 14 innings, right?
Yeah.
And Yusei Kikuchi pitches innings 10 through 14 and he's the hero and the Jays walk. Like, that's like almost your best case, right? And it's not to say that you plan for him to be part of things, but if you don't have him around, then, you know, you don't have quite as much length, and he does give you a nice insurance policy.
Is there a world where Yusei Kikuchi is like Andrew Miller on this team next year? He's a reliever and he's going two inning outings and you just kind of put the whole starting thing away and you just use him in this role and try to juice the velocity up and rely on the stuff and put him in better positions to succeed?
To me, you take him to spring next year, you hope these adjustments continue, stretch him out, he's a starter. But we'll see.
We shall see. We're going to step away, but when we come back, we're going to talk celebrations. We're going to talk more Jays Mariners, and we got one more mailbag question to get to when we continue on At the Letters.
I can't imagine, through the kind of season you've had, Bo, how satisfying this one is. What are you thinking about right now?
Yeah, I mean, this is what it's about, you know. It's about getting to the playoffs and having opportunities. I feel like we're growing up in front of the world, so we just go out there.
It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith, live and in person, a rare thing for us from
yes.
Blue Jays workout day here on Thursday, October 6th, ahead of this weekend's wildcard series against the Seattle Mariners. Thanks, Christian Ryan and Devlin Brand, for their work on this episode of At the Letters. And it's time now for Major League Beer for Major League Baseball, brought to you by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Ben, you tipped your hand as to your opinion on this, but I would like you to expand on it. Blue Jays celebrated a postseason clinch last Friday. They clinched on the off day. They came in on the Friday. They had already premeditated their celebration. Win or loss against the Boston Red Sox, they were going to celebrate. If they lost 12-0, they were going to celebrate. They ended up winning like 9-1, so you know, didn't really have to worry about that. But they celebrated anyway. Where are you at on the amount of celebrating by postseason clubs, the intensity of celebrations, the spraying of champagne, the jumping up and down, the way that ball players whoop it up when they clinch the postseason? And I mean, we'll see it again, but from whoever wins this wildcard series too.
Yes, there will be another celebration in Toronto.
Yes.
The Blue Jays sincerely hoping that there's more than one. It's been a while, certainly, since the Jays had the chance to celebrate like that. And to me, every single time that you have the chance to celebrate in the baseball season, go for it. I mean, I don't mean after every single win you're not celebrating like that. But if you clinch something, if you clinch a division, a playoff berth, it is a very long season. It's a demanding season. These players put in a ton of effort and time to get to where they want to go. And more often than not, you don't make the playoffs. There are 18 teams right now that are packing their bags and preparing for 2023. The Jays are not one of them. And every single time that they reach that next threshold, then they've earned that chance to celebrate, and they should spray as much champagne at each other as they possibly can.
Some people would say you haven't actually won anything yet. You just qualified for the playoffs. You just qualified for this dumb little tournament that you play at the end of the year. You don't see NBA teams doing this. You don't see NHL teams reacting like this when they qualify for the playoffs. Why do baseball teams do it, Ben?
Well, you know, 12 teams out of 30, that's a pretty tough ratio to get into. And also, I don't know, if I do think it's a little different if you have 16 out of 30 qualifying in the NHL or NBA playoffs. But even then, if, I don't know, what's the 8 seed in the NBA? The Atlanta Hawks? Like, what's the, are the Columbus Blue Jackets like an 8 seed? And I'm just making
some
these
500
teams
team.
Yeah. They want to get in and celebrate? I don't care. That's fine.
Yeah.
It's a long season. You want one chance to spray some champagne and pour some Miller Lights on each other? No issue with that whatsoever. So, yeah, I don't have a problem with it. I do think it's interesting, too, you know, that you look at just some of these celebrations and the lineups that teams play the next day, the quote-unquote hangover game, I think that's a bit of a myth too.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. These players are like 23, 24, 25. They were playing at, what, 3 p.m. the next day. Remember when you were in your early to mid-20s and you'd go out and have a few and you'd have something to do the next day in the middle of the afternoon? You couldn't do it. Like, you couldn't get yourself together. You couldn't have a Gatorade. By the way, these are professional athletes who have access to, like, IVs and all kinds of, you know, potions and electrolytes that'll perk you right up. And these are also extremely well-conditioned young men who are playing this sport. They have no problem getting up to play a game the next day. You think guys don't go out and, like, have a few during the regular season?
You don't think that they can get booze on the charter?
Yeah.
Every single road trip? It's not like it's hard to access.
Yeah. Yeah. So players are going out and drinking during the year, and they are coming back and playing the next day. You think the Red Sox weren't hungover on the Saturday when they just lost on a Friday night and they're all staying in downtown Toronto, King West right there? You think some of them weren't going out enjoying themselves at the end of a season that's going nowhere? Yeah, I think the hangover game's a myth.
I think it's a total myth. I really do. I think that sometimes teams choose to rest their players. And I'm not saying that there's never been a player, or even in 2022, that there aren't sometimes players who show up really hungover and don't play. I'm sure that happens. I don't know specific examples of that. I'm sure that happens because you're talking about a group of 700 to 1,000 individuals. And that's, in any group that big, you're going to have some people who show up to work really hungover. But it, by and large, the day after you clinch, I mean, it also starts at like 10, 11 p.m. Yeah. And it's not like they're day drinking and sitting there all, in the sun all day getting dehydrated. They're athletes. They're hydrated, like you said. They're in physical prime that most of us can't imagine. It's a myth.
And when it comes to the celebrations, like, it's just a baseball thing. And, like, I hate to even put it this way, but, like, you just have to be there to understand. Like, you just have to be close to the game to get it and to understand why they do it. And I think people always – I can never – properly relate to people the grind of a baseball season. I haven't figured out how to do it, right? Because there are still these ideas that, like, oh, baseball players aren't real athletes and they're lazy and they don't work that hard. Like, you have no idea the physical and mental grind of a baseball season. We're very fortunate and privileged to see it up close and to get a real, like, appreciation for how hard it is to get through a baseball season. 7 months. Like, I was just complaining earlier this podcast about how we've been doing this for 7 months. We haven't had to go out and play the game every night.
No, our seats are pretty comfortable.
Right? And so we don't travel as much as the players do. We travel a lot, and that is grueling and tiring and changes you as a person. But for them, the travel is that much more extreme. And yes, they're on charters, and, like, yes, they have nice hotels, but it's still hard. And it's still such a grind. So I do think that when you do accomplish something at the end of a long year, that just release and just letting off that steam is important and meaningful and is something that ball players should do, because it is just so mentally grueling and taxing to get through a baseball season. And as you said, 18 of 30 teams get to the end and are just like, wow, I am wiped. I am, like, physically completely depleted. Like, I'm like 20 pounds lighter than I was literally when I started this year. I've lost all my muscle tissue. Mentally, I'm just defeated. And, like, I don't know who's my friend and who's my enemy in this clubhouse anymore. And I've gone through all these, like, ups and downs interpersonally with everybody around the organization. And I've dealt with all this failure for 7 months. I don't even really know how to process anymore. And now I just go home. For the Toronto Blue Jays, they're one of 12 teams that gets to go on and play for something and get to do something great and be remembered for a very long time and make really, like, meaningful, indelible moments in a city like Toronto, which is a great place to play. So absolutely, you celebrate. Absolutely, you let off that steam and you decompress.
100%. And I think, like, you could take the Yankees view, or, like, the Steinbrenner Yankees view of, like, if we don't win the World Series, this season's been a failure. I'm like, okay, I mean, if that's how you want to define success, like, yeah, all right, I guess. And the Yankees succeed by any measure a lot of the time. But by another measure, like, there are 29 teams that don't win it every single year. And those teams are filled with individuals who are accomplishing things at the height of their profession. And every celebration, no one says this, but the unsaid part of every celebration is that you might not get to do it again. That might be it for the Blue Jays. And so you're going to go all this time and not celebrate once?
Yeah. The cool thing about also this Blue Jays group is they really have been together for a long time. And they really do know each other really well. And that goes to coaching staff as well. Like, John Schneider has had all of these guys for a long, long time. Like, you think about it, like, he had Tim Mesa in Vancouver in 2014. He had Kevin Biggio in Lansing in 2016. He had Vlad, Bo, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. at multiple levels, All of them won a championship in 2018 with the New Hampshire Fisher Cats. Santiago Espinal was on that team. Jordan Romano was on that team. And all the names I just listed. Danny Jansen. John Schneider's known Danny Jansen since 2013.
Wild.
At friggin' in the Gulf Coast League. Danny Jansen was like 17, bat first, catcher, had trouble throwing on a line to second base from behind the plate. Now you look at Danny Jansen as a big league catcher now with a very capable arm, and dude's like about to become a father, right? Like, he's a different person now. It's been a decade. Like, John Schneider like rode buses with all these guys, and John Schneider was at the complex with all these guys, and he has kind of climbed that organizational ladder along with them. Now he runs that clubhouse. Now he is in charge. Of course he wants them to celebrate. Of course he wants to be a part of it with them, right? Of course he wants to take part in this moment. This is like a group that's known each other for a very long time. So I think that them all getting to this point now where they're about to play in the postseason is really significant and meaningful for them.
Agreed. And last thing on this, I guess we had a lot to say on these celebrations. last thing on this for me is, like, some guys probably don't need that much of an excuse to let loose. Like, it's just, again, think of any group. Some guys are just going to be more keen to seek out that outlet for their celebration. But for others, this might be their moment with the team where they're really celebrating together. So again, all those reasons. So you see Pete Walker in there celebrating with the players. That, I will tell you, that's not happening on a normal Friday, you know, but you clinch. Okay, now they're pouring beer and champagne on Pete Walker.
We beat the Detroit Tigers in May. Go nuts. I did have a bit of a sneaky ancillary reason for bringing up the coaching staff, though, and that was to get to our third and final mailbag winner. Congratulations to Bev Massaros. I assume Beverly, but just says Bev here. So congratulations, Bev. And Bev asks, can you see all the coaching staff being back for next year?
Well, they have a big coaching staff. I would say no. I would say expect change. This is a team that made a massive change mid-season in firing Charlie Montoyo and bringing John Schneider in as the interim manager. With that, Casey Candel became the interim bench coach. So this is a team that remains in flux. Now, I think John Schneider will be back and should be back as the manager of this team for 2023 and beyond. But you got a big staff. And again, the bench coach position is one that I look at. Again, interim bench coach, right? Candel is not the permanent bench coach of this team. I think Pete Walker will be back. I think we'll see a lot of familiar faces, but I think we'll see some change.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the interim tag will be removed from John Schneider's title, and he will just be the manager of this club going forward. And congratulations to him if that happens, because he has earned it, and he has grinded his way, as I just said, up every level of this organization. And I think he's doing a really spectacular job over the last, what's it been now, 3 months, maybe not even, since Charlie Montoyo was dismissed. I think John Schneider's been excellent.
Yeah.
I really think he's done a fantastic job. So I would I think he should be back, and I think that he will be back. And yeah, I agree with you that there will be some changes on his staff. I think that's just natural. And I don't know this offhand, but I doubt there's ever been 2 years where the entire coaching staff has been completely consistent. There are always little changes within, and it's typically at the field coordinator level, or like the hitting strategist level, or something like that. I don't think there's going to be anything huge and dramatic, but I do think there will be some tweaks to the coaching staff.
Yeah, think about it this way too. Like, the bigger the coaching staffs get, and they're big right now, I don't have it in front of me, but like a dozen coaches, it's on the back of the scorecards we use here at Rogers Center. It's like 12, 13 coaches. And so you have that many people, there's a good chance that there could be some change. So great question. And we'll learn more probably by winter meetings. They usually have that sort of thing finalized.
Yeah,
early part of the 23 season.
Kind of somewhere, prior to Christmas, typically. Because prior to the holidays, I should say, because you don't usually deal with that. You like to have some certainty for your staff members going into the holidays. Any kind of underrated aspect to this Blue Jays Mariners series that you would point to? Like, we talked about the pitching matchup a little bit. I don't know if you want to get back a bit more into the offense, or maybe even into the defense a little bit. We saw the Blue Jays doing PFP today on the field. We saw the Blue Jays doing a lot of defensive drills on the field. They seem like pretty committed to not beating themselves, to saying, look, if we get beat by a better team, fine, that's one thing, but we're not going to do anything to beat ourselves. Any kind of underrated things that you would point to in this series?
I would point to the lefties and the switch hitters on Seattle. There are a lot of them, and, you know, of course, some big names there like Kelnick and Carlos Santana and others. So that's going to pose some challenges for the Jays as they navigate that lineup inning to inning, because Tim Mayza is great. He's had an amazing season, but he can only pitch so much. Even if you use him every day, which should be on the table, these guys should be available for three in a row. But even if you do that, that's what, four outs? You know, like, you still have other situations. So that's where Trevor Richards could be important. That's part of the reason I think they roster Yusei Kikuchi. And ultimately, right-handers are going to have to get those lefties and switch hitters out, which they've done before. But yeah, to me, that does jump out.
It starts with Alek Manoah, because Alek Manoah this year had a 326 weighted on base against lefties, 231 against righties. It's a big difference, right? So if there has been one way to get Alek Manoah, it's been with lefties.
Well, and on those lines, Jose Berríos allowed an 898 OPS to lefties this year. So that, to me, is another reason you probably start Strip.
Yep. You think about it, the Mariners this year were a top 12 lineup against right-handed sinkers. So that applies to Berríos. That applies to Manoah. That applies to Strip a little bit too. He likes to use his sinker, although Strip is more so like, let me pitch to the lineup's weaknesses. So he might put that pitch away a little bit against the Mariners. But the Mariners had a 348 weighted on base against right-handed sinkers. That's a big pitch for those three guys. The other interesting thing, the Mariners were MLB's second worst team by weighted on base against off-speed pitches. So you could get them with off-speed pitches. So think about Gausman's splitter. Think about Stripling's changeup, right? Those are pitches that you can exploit the Mariners with.
Manoah's slider, obviously.
Yeah, right? So that's something that I'm going to be looking at in this series. You might want to stay away from the fastballs against this Mariners lineup. Another one that I like, another thing that I would point to as an underrated thing that maybe hasn't been discussed enough would be Kevin Gausman's outing against the Mariners in May. It was suspicious. His lowest strikeout total of the year, tied for his lowest strikeout total of the year in that outing. Just three. Five innings, seven hits, two earned runs. It was May 18th at Rogers Center. He gave up his first home run of the season in that outing. It was one of those days where, like, the splitter just was not fooling hitters. There were only 18 swings on 38 splitters thrown in that outing. Only five whiffs. Six of them fouled off, seven put in play. So the Mariners just taking the splitter. They were seeing it, they knew what was coming, and they were not swinging at it. Meanwhile, 40 fastballs thrown in that outing, 25 swings. Mariners were on the fastball, zero swinging strikes on the fastball in that outing. So for some reason, what Kevin Gausman usually likes to do, disguising the fastball and the splitter, right? That's how he gets swing and miss on the fastball. A, it's like 96, 97, and that's a pretty good big league weapon, but also hitters think it's a splitter and they swing under it. Wasn't working against the Mariners that day. Cal Raleigh hit a home run off of a fastball in the fifth inning, first homer that Strip gave up all year.
Gausman, yeah.
15 fastballs fouled off, 10 put in play. Something suspicious going on in that outing, and I don't know what it was. I don't know if he was tipping. I don't know if the Mariners just had like a great game plan and were like, look, if we see it down, we're taking it, and if we see it up, we're gonna go after it. But for some reason, his splitter was not as effective that day. His fastball was being attacked, and he didn't strike out a bunch of batters that day either.
Really interesting. Yeah, I did not realize that. This, you know, speaking of how long the season is, that game is just gone from my memory. It never happened.
I had to look it up. This wasn't just off the top of my head. I had to look that up.
That's interesting stuff. I think, yeah, definitely if you're the Jays, you want to do everything you can to make sure that there's no tell that Gausman has. For the Mariners, too, he might be opposing Robbie Ray if things play out on Saturday that way. And if I'm the Jays, I really would want Pete Walker to sit in the hitter's meeting that day, not the pitcher's meeting, hitter's meeting, and say, this is what Robbie Ray does. Look for this. This is how you can get to him. It sounds almost cruel, but like, this is the playoffs. Like, you have to, any weakness that Robbie Ray has, exploit it, expose it. This is the Jays' chance.
Is there anybody in baseball who could offer a better scouting report on Robbie Ray than Pete Walker?
So right. This is perfect for the Jays in a way. He's the one who turned Robbie Ray's career around. If anyone can undo him, now's the time, Pete.
He knows exactly what Robbie's trying to do in certain counts, exactly what he goes to when things aren't going right. He knows what makes him tick. He knows what gets him off of his game. He knows what rattles him. Like he knows like really intricate details. Like he knows him really well. Personally, right? And I'm sure those guys, like, honestly, like, really like each other and feel really strongly about one another. But when it comes to competition on Saturday, it's going to be, we got to beat you. So I'm going to exploit every weakness that I know about you. And Pete Walker knows those weaknesses when it comes to Robbie Ray. So we can tell Blue Jays hitters, like, look for this, look for that. Blue Jays hitters can be really well prepared. The other thing I would point to, Robbie Ray in his last outing against Oakland, and who knows, maybe it was just one bad outing. He gave up 3 homers, and he was giving up home runs to, like, not great hitters in that outing. I mean, we're talking about, like, Christian Pache and Nick Allen. I mean, there just aren't good hitters in Oakland's lineup, but we're talking about particularly not good hitters and guys without a lot of power, and they were playing in Seattle, which, like, isn't the easiest place to hit a home run. Pache and Allen are taking you deep. It's kind of interesting that Robbie Ray has given up some homers coming into the postseason. I mean, Luis Castillo had a couple clunkers down the stretch as well. These aren't guys who are coming in to the playoffs like Alek Manoah is, coming off of a September when he had a 0.88 ERA.
Historic, yeah. And Alek Manoah, just as a quick aside, needs to get Cy Young consideration. I don't vote for that, so easy for me to say. But really, I mean, he had a phenomenal season. He should be top 3 for that award, in my opinion, after posting second best ERA in Blue Jays history.
Alek Manoah trying to make sure they stay there, as he will do his part here tonight. Really as popular as any player on the team. And if you were voting, Buck, for a team MVP, this would be a good place to start the conversation.
No question about it, because he has so much to do with the Blue Jays and how they are performing this year. And I would give him my vote, of course.
This podcast is about the playoffs, but, I mean, shout out to Alek Manoah for that season. Now, Robbie Ray, I had to look this up, and so some of our listeners might not know it. His year was good in Seattle, 3.71 ERA, 212 strikeouts, 189 innings. That's a great season by Robbie Ray, but as you said, Arden, you know, you look at the home run total, which is 32. There is a way to get to Robbie Ray, and it is with the long ball.
I think for the Mariners to win this series, they need Luis Castillo and Robbie Ray to be really, really good. Like, they need them to be spectacular, throwing dominant, ace-like outings. Because I think Toronto has a much better lineup than the Mariners, and it's tough, right? Because the Mariners are a little bit banged up right now. Like, they're not going to have Haggerty, they're not going to have Winker. Like, they're, you know, Carlos Santana might be hitting cleanup. Like, he did not have a great year. You know, Mitch Haniger is a guy, you talk to some, you know, some former players, and they're like, yeah, it gets a little tense in big moments. Like, they certainly don't have the depth of lineup. Like, they don't have producers towards the bottom that the Blue Jays could. Like, if Matt Chapman's hitting 6 or 7, if Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is on the roster and hitting towards the bottom of the lineup, if Whit Merrifield can keep doing what he's been doing, right? I just think that you like the Blue Jays offense in this series a lot more. I think both bullpens are kind of so-so, and, you know, the Mariners maybe have a bit more velo, but I mean, Blue Jays bullpen deserves some respect for what it did down the stretch. And I really just think for the Mariners to win, they need those two guys going in games 1 and 2 to be really, really, really good. I think that's how they win this series.
And they can be, because those guys are really good pitchers. Logan Gilbert, too, finished strong in September. In October, 6 starts, 2 ERA. I mean, he's been phenomenal for them at times and really finished strong. So that's a scary 3 for the Jays to potentially face. You know, you mentioned Whit Merrifield there, and we really haven't talked about him a lot on ATL because he's just not really played that well until recently. Or that much. Now he's playing all the time and he's playing great. So my read is he's the starting second baseman for this team at this point. I mean, is that how you see it unfolding?
I think Santiago Espinal will be on the roster, and I think Whit Merrifield will start at second base.
Agreed.
I think that's what'll happen in game 1. And look, I talked to Whit about, like, a week ago. It was when they were in Toronto. So it was before they left for the Baltimore series, and I kind of went up to him and I was like, hey man, are you doing anything different with your swing now? Like, because I had gone in and I'd been, like, looking at the exit velos, like, man, he's striking the ball way better, the ball's coming off his bat a lot faster. So you do, and I'd looked at video, nothing looked, you know, different to me, and I was like, are you doing anything different? And he, like, looked at me like I was the dumbest man in the world. He was like, no man, I'm just playing. Like, I'm just playing now. And he didn't have that playing time before. And look, he hadn't earned it, right? When he came over to Toronto, the Blue Jays said he was coming over to be an everyday player. He did play pretty frequently when he first came over, and then he played his way out of that run. If you think about it, Whit Merrifield was MLB's Iron Man, like earlier this year. Played 553 consecutive games. So think about how important routines are for ball players, right? And comfort is for ball players. Well, Whit Merrifield did the exact same thing every single day for over 550 games. And then he had to do things differently. And I think it was a struggle for him, honestly. I think that the different rhythm and the different routines and not really knowing how to prepare for games and not really knowing when his opportunities were going to come, I don't think that benefited him. And like I said, he was an earning run. You know, he's on a much better team now. It's one thing to play 553 straight for the Kansas City Royals from 2016 to 2021 or whatever the years were. It's another to do it for the Blue Jays, who have a deep and talented lineup. Like, you got to earn your way into this lineup. But I just think that with the benefit of more regular playing time, Whit Merrifield has kind of rediscovered, you know, what he was able to do earlier in his career. He doesn't think that he's at a point where he should be declining. And, you know, that you can argue with that if you want. Like, obviously he is getting a little bit older into his career. He's clearly on the back nine of it, but I think that he feels like he's still got a lot to offer. And he feels like, with the benefit of more regular playing time, like, he just feels a lot more like himself, and he's able to kind of find this hot streak that he hasn't been able to find all year.
Well, and what this means now for the Jays is you've got Merrifield hitting ninth. You've got Danny Jansen hitting like seventh a lot of the time as the DH. You've got maybe Tapia is your eight hitter. It is a deep lineup, and it's no fluke that they led the American League in batting average, on base percentage, slugging percentage. They're one of the best lineups that you're going to find in the playoffs. And so that's a strength for this team. You know, as much as Castillo and Ray could be a duo that powers the Mariners past the Jays to the Astros, you look at this Jays lineup, they can score 8 runs against anyone.
I was searching for it there. The other thing that he said that I was trying to get to and I couldn't remember, he feels just more confident now, and he feels like subconsciously there's a little bit of a lack of confidence when things weren't going his way and when he wasn't playing regularly, he was kind of facing some adversity. He feels like subconsciously a little bit of a lack of confidence bled in to his plate appearances, and he kind of told me now, like, I'm seeing the ball fall in, right? And when things go well for you, you're just going to be more confident. It's just a natural thing with whatever you do. So he does feel like he's kind of, you know, rolling on that confidence right now. The other thing I'll say with Whit Merrifield, like, doing a lot of little things, they're helping his team win. Man, that ball that he scored on from third base in Baltimore in the first game of that series, like the fifth inning, and Dean Kramer's on the mound, right? And so Dean Kramer, in his first plate appearance against Bo Bichette, threw him like a ton of breaking balls. And Whit Merrifield's watching that from the Blue Jays dugout, just like, huh. Like, Kramer's throwing Bichette a ton of breaking balls. So Merrifield gets on base, like, later in the game, it's fifth inning, he gets to third base, and he goes to Louis Rivera. He's like, hey, man, like, Bo's up. Kramer threw him a bunch of breaking balls his last time up. I'm sitting on a breaking ball in the dirt here, and I'm going to go on it. And so Louis was like, okay, yeah, sure, man. Like, and I don't know, next pitch, two pitches later, Kramer spikes a breaking ball in the dirt. It goes maybe like 5 feet from Adley Rutschman. It went like, it barely went past the home plate cutout. And Merrifield is just like racing home the second that ball hits the dirt. Like, that focus and that anticipation, thinking of the game, noticing little things like that in the game, those little things could like come up huge in a postseason moment.
Well, what a break by Merrifield. He broke as soon as that ball hit the dirt from third base and scores easily on the wild pitch. Boy, he's got great instincts as a base runner.
Yes, he does, and he might be the Blue Jays base runner. You're at third base.
And if you're in August and that happens, you forget about it. You go on to the next game. But, you know, you think about the playoffs, and the last time the Jays were here, it was the Donaldson dash, right? Yeah. He's sliding across home plate against the Texas Rangers as the Blue Jays advanced to play Cleveland in the ALCS in 2016. That was good base running by Josh Donaldson. It was aggressive base running by Donaldson. And those sorts of decisions, I mean, obviously within reason, but those decisions can be really helpful.
Prediction time. What is your prediction for the series? What do you think is going to happen between the Blue Jays and Mariners in the wild card series?
All right. I like predictions. I'm going to say Jays sweep.
I agree. How do they do it? I'll tell you what they're going to do. Jays are going to sweep. Game one, they're going to win by like a couple runs, two or three, Jordan Romano is going to get like a 5-out save. Game two is going to be tied going into extras, and Ooh. George Springer is going to walk it off.
Wow.
That's what's going to happen.
You say Kikuchi winning pitcher?
I'm not going that far.
Yeah, I could see a Springer walk off or a lead off. I could see a Springer lead off home run at some point, walk off. Yeah, I like that call. You heard it here first, folks.
Why do you think the Blue Jays sweep?
I do think they're the better team.
Yeah.
So, of course, I'm going to pick them. You win one, you have a lot of momentum, and it's just one more win at that point.
I'll say this. I think they sweep because the Mariners have been scuffling this month, have not been playing impressive baseball, have been coughing up games to not very good opposition, the Angels and Oakland, and the Blue Jays are just surging. They're peaking at the right time. Honestly, I think the Blue Jays have played their best baseball all season over the last 4 weeks. 22-11 in September/October, nearly a +50 run differential. I get that a lot of it was against the Boston Red Sox. But I think if you really watch this team, you understand that right now, offensively, starting pitching, bullpen, defense, not beating yourself, not committing little unforced errors, the Blue Jays are kind of checking all the boxes right now, and they've kind of come together and peaked at the perfect time. So I think just what have you done for me lately? I think on current form, the Blue Jays are the better team right now. The better team on paper, more talented team, I think, but also just playing the best baseball right now. So that's why I think the Blue Jays sweep.
And they have been able to line things up pretty nicely. Even resting Springer for the doubleheader, lining up their starting rotation. We weren't sure if they were going to have to, consider using an Alek Manoah for a few innings in a game 162. None of that had to happen. They didn't even have to consider it seriously. So these guys are as rested as you could hope for the most part. We'll see what happens with Lourdes and Espinal, but they're in a very good position, very good team. And yeah, we're both calling a sweep here. How about that?
I am not as rested as you would hope.
I didn't say you were rested.
Not for the least part, but that's okay. We'll get through it. Thanks to Devlin Brand for helping us out on site here at Rogers Center Blue Jays Workout Day. Thanks for Christian Ryan for all the heavy lifting he always does on the podcast. Thanks to all of you for listening. Enjoy the wild card series this weekend. Live it up. This is what you get through the entire season for. This is what it is. This is the moment that you should really enjoy. The Blue Jays are back in the postseason. It's going to be a really fun series. Win, lose. Ben and I will be back afterwards to recap it and perhaps set up where the Blue Jays go from here. Until then, we'll talk to you next time on At the Letters.